Please be seated. As we left this earlier today, 0908, in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 10.035b1, Ms. Howell was addressing the court, and I gave her the opportunity to again meet with us after the lunch hour, and I gave Attorney Stephen Levine the opportunity to speak after Ms. Howell did. And is there anyone in the courtroom who wishes to speak on this matter? Hearing none, Attorney Howell. I think we need a microphone. Okay, good.
Just use my hacky voice. That would take care of it, right? I just wanted to address two issues that were raised this morning, including one that you suggested we think about over the lunch hour, and sort of sum up my presentation this morning on those two issues. The first one that I want to address is the suggestion that was made this morning that perhaps adopting a stricter standard and more detailed language in the rules would be likely to lead to less litigation on these issues among the bar and its members in the future. And unfortunately, I believe that the likely result of a stronger standard and additional language is likely to be just the opposite. I believe that what was likely to happen is, regardless of what this court decides the standard is, the constitutional standard is what the constitutional standard is. And if we have additional language in the rule, we're going to end up with litigation about, is this under the court standard or is this the constitutional standard? And so as the Bar's Board of Governors has adopted the proposed rule, the proposal from the Bar is simply to follow what the constitutional standard is, so we don't have extraneous litigation about which standard applies and are we talking about the Wisconsin rules? Are we talking about the federal rules? Are we talking about an arbitration language, et cetera? The federal standard is the standard that governs because of the fact that this is a mandatory bar, and that's the language that's been proposed by the state bar.
And that's just to delete political or ideological activities in two places.
That's correct.
Okay.
The second issue I wanted to address is that in the event that the court is inclined to include language along the lines of just trying to describe the burden of proof, and as you saw, I was struggling with that concept this morning, and I can't say that I have language that I think we should propose or anything else, but I think the best analogy to help think about that is the sliding scale that's used in an injunction case, where the higher the likelihood of success on the merits, the lower the irreparable harm and vice versa. I think the same type of a sliding scale applies here in the sense that the higher the First Amendment impingement of the particular activity that's at issue is involved, the closer the connection needs to be to the two purposes identified in Keller. I think that's what the law is already. I don't know that it needs to be in the rule, but to the extent that there's a reason to put something like that in the rule, I think that's the kind of an analogy that makes some sense as you think about it from a drafting standpoint. And I think it's important because the nightmare I have is that if you try to impose specific categories, the first thing you're going to have is a question is which category does it fall in? And, oh, gee, if it's a 3.5 as opposed to a 4, then do we go to this one? Do we go to that one? I think leaving it as a sliding scale in a context that lawyers and courts are used to dealing with makes some sense. Because this is a very fact-specific inquiry. Each time we've had an arbitration challenging the bar's activities, it's been for a very specific activity in a very specific context. And as a result, and typically even when the bar reviews its own activities to determine the dues reduction each year, it looks at very specific activities in very specific contexts, and that's why the number changes. You heard this morning that a couple of years ago it was up to $10 for the dues reduction, and then it went back down to $5. In fact, on an average, it's generally run $4 to $8 per year over the last 20 years. One year it was 10 because there was an awful lot of legislative activity that year, and the bar properly found that those activities were non-chargeable, so the dues reduction was higher. But it's a very fact-specific inquiry, and trying to put too close a structure on it in my view, will only lead to more litigation about whether it's inside or outside that structure. And so given the fact that we have a very clear rule from the federal courts and that that's the rule from a constitutional standpoint that we're going to have to be dealing with in the event of objections, that's why I think that the language that's been proposed by the bar is workable, it's straightforward, it's what's required, and it has worked generally well over the last 20 years.
Is this too simplistic? I view the state bar as embracing the majority in Kingston, and that your opposing counsel is embracing the dissent.
I think that's fair. In fact, I would suggest that, in fact, the petitioners probably go beyond the dissent in the sense that the standard that they're suggesting be applied be so high and be so tight that it would go even beyond what I believe Justice Sykes would suggest in her dissent. But I think the basic dichotomy is what is fair.
Well, Judge Sykes agreed with the standard. She just didn't agree with the application, although she didn't agree that she thought that this deference was not really deference. It was an abdication of all responsibility of doing that. I've forgotten the word.
Meaningless
was the word she used, yeah.
Yeah, she agreed with the verbal formulation of the standard.
Right.
She didn't agree how the definition of germaneness was, the breadth of the definition of germaneness.
And she agreed with the standard. She didn't agree that there should be that kind of deference to the state bar.
I think that's correct.
And so she would have had an en banc about the application of that standard to the state bar activities.
As I understand, she was the only one who voted in favor of that, yes.
Ms. Hall, I'm a bit curious as to what committee or what group at the state bar actually makes this evaluation each year. Is there an executive committee that acts in this regard?
Yes, each year what happens, from the way the process works, is the state bar staff is charged with the job of going through every single activity for the most recent year in which there's an audited financial statement. So that would be essentially the most immediate past year. And to go through and identify anything that might be considered non-chargeable under the applicable standard. Obviously, up until a couple years ago, the first cut was whether it was political or ideological. This last session, it was just everything. Then a book is put together, and I do mean a book. It's actually usually a couple of binders that are about yay thick, and the executive committee of the state bar meets in what turns out to be generally an all-afternoon session to go through every single one of those pieces of paper and those activities and say, okay, here's the activity. Is this reasonably related? Is it not? And then based on those determinations, the state bar staff calculates the amount of the dues reduction and the pro rata share of general and administrative expenses that are applicable to those activities. And then that goes to the Board of Governors for approval, I believe, generally at its December meeting.
Thank you. That's helpful.
What precisely is your recommendation to us from the bar?
The bar's recommendation is that Exhibit A to the materials that you received this morning, with respect to the rule, which is the first paragraph of that attachment, the recommendation is to remove the words political and ideological, and again, as I mentioned this morning, to remove any doubt that we are in fact using the exact standard that comes from the language of the cases, to add the words necessarily or before the word reasonably related to the regulating of the legal profession. So that language as proposed in Exhibit A is the recommendation of the Bar's Board of Governors.
I'm not sure that I shouldn't speak for the other members of the court. I don't have Exhibit A.
You did not get an Exhibit A?
No.
It's attached.
I know, but what is attached here to mine is bylaws. But I don't.
Well, the first paragraph is the rule, and the rest of it is the bylaws. SCR 10.035B1 should be the very first paragraph.
Yeah, I got that. Mm-hmm.
Where do you want the necessarily or you've added? So looking at SCR 10.035B, which is Exhibit A, attached to your email this morning, what you would do then is, in the second line, you struck out not. You would insert the. In the third line, you cross out to that use for political or ideological, and instead you insert as provided in SCR 10.035B3 to fund only those. And then you insert necessarily or reasonably. That's right out of the opinion of Kingstead. That's right. And then again, you cross out the political or ideological language and insert all others instead.
But you changed intended to related, and we talked about that this cases use incurred or intended.
Right.
So you've changed that. Why did you change the whole structure of this? Why not just do what Mr. Attorney Levine suggested? Is there any difference? Just saying the State Farm may not use compulsory dues of any member who objects to that use for activities that are not, and then would use necessarily or reasonably intended, which is the same language, for the purpose of regulating. Is that any different?
The reason for the changes is that, in my view, as we were looking at this, there's some confusion. If you could then go to the next line, it says those activities without the political and ideological, and it's not entirely clear what those refers to. So the structure was changed to be as clear as possible as to what activities may be funded with mandatory dues and that all other activities, which activities are subject to objection from use of mandatory dues and that all other activities be used for those other purposes.
Okay. But you don't think it changes the meaning at all?
I don't believe so.
Other than you change language related to incurred or intended. Okay.
Again, that was a phrase right out of one of the cases, and that's where the language comes from. It was not intended to change the meaning of the rule.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Help me with this. Just in a off-the-cuff reading, intended for the purpose of is narrower than related to. You know, if something is intended, that's a narrower concept. Why are you telling me, hey, don't worry, it's the same thing? Because it looks to me like it's different. So I must need to know more than I know.
Well, in the case law, the two phrases are used interchangeably depending on how short the court tends to try to make its sentences.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that the mandatory bar, what makes the mandatory bar constitutional under the First Amendment is these two purposes, regulating the legal profession and improving the quality.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that it can engage in activities with mandatory dues over the objection of a member, it needs to be dues that are related to those purposes. That's the formulation.
Yep.
Sometimes the court says it in one way, and sometimes it says it in another. The intent is the same. It just happens to be two different verbal formulations that the court uses, and that's where that came from.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions of Attorney Howell? Hearing none, I want to, on behalf of the court, thank you for your appearance today, Attorney Howell, and for the bar's work on this petition, which is, as you all point out, necessary in order to have the SCR comply with the constitutional requirements as set forth by the Seventh Circuit. Whether or not this court is bound by the Seventh Circuit's view of the federal Constitution, and as you know, it is not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Levine.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first point that I have written down in my notes from this morning is exactly the point that you just brought up, Justice Bradley. I do believe that the State Bar has proposed language that changes the word intended that is in the rule right now to related to is specifically in there to broaden that standard, so that I think you are making a substantive change if you change intended to related to as suggested by the state bar. And I would suggest if the court agrees with our first proposed change but doesn't agree with the second one, to do what you suggested, Justice Abrahamson, just leave the rule alone, except strike the words political or ideological.
There may have to be a change in the third sentence. The state bar shall fund those activities with, I have to read it more carefully than I am at the bench at the moment, whether those activities are referred to activities not intended. But that's a semantic matter and can be changed by just, instead of saying those activities, describe the activities we're talking about.
It may be. It may be determinative later on. The second point that I have is about the clear and convincing standard of review. I think, as you said this morning, Justice Abrahamson, that is a middle ground standard of review. And the more I thought about that over lunch, the more I thought that's a better standard of review than just preponderance of the evidence when it's stated to an arbitrator. When I think of preponderance of the evidence, the first thing that comes to mind to me is you're talking about weight of the evidence. You're comparing maybe if one side brings in an elephant-sized load of evidence and another side brings in a donkey-sized load of evidence, that the arbitrator is going to say preponderance of the evidence means the amount of evidence or the weight of evidence, rather than, I think, clear and convincing is more talking about the quality of evidence rather than the amount of evidence.
Finally, you know, studies show that juries have a hard time drawing a line between preponderance and clear and convincing.
Maybe. The most important
judges
point...
Judges can, right?
Yes.
Judges sometimes have a hard time,
yes.
too.
Go ahead.
The third point, and the point that I think that is most important, there was a great deal of discussion this morning, and Attorney Howell suggested to the court that the Seventh Circuit's decision does not prevent any party, including a challenger to a state bar expenditure, from providing proof before an arbitrator, from introducing evidence to show that the expenditure was not made for either one of the two allowable reasons, regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. And that may very well be. An arbitrator may still allow any evidence a party wants to introduce. But under the standards set forth by the Seventh Circuit, that doesn't matter as long as the State Bar sets forth a theory which makes a connection between the expenditure and regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. Under the bar's reasonable basis standard of review, it's that theory that outweighs any evidence that a party will introduce in a proceeding. So I think it's very important for the court to put in that statement about clear and convincing evidence, and that the bar must prove that the expenditure was made primarily and substantially for either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. Finally, you mentioned this morning, Justice Abrahamson, that the bar has provided you with a copy of the bylaw that it amended over the weekend, and one of the provisions in there was to provide for a de novo review of any arbitration proceeding. I haven't had time to think about that. Last night, when I came home from a pleasant afternoon at 6 o'clock in the evening, I opened up my computer to find the state bar's submission to this court. If we lived in a perfect world, I would have wished that that would have been provided to the court a couple of weeks ahead of time so that I would have had time to look at the cases cited and to look at the other material so that I could have adequately replied to the state bar. But I think the question that the court might ask itself is, in light of the state bar change in its bylaws, and the state bar can change that bylaw in arbitration anytime it wants, what's the use of even having an arbitration procedure if you're going to have de novo review? I mean, the whole idea of arbitration is as an alternative to litigation. If you're going to provide for de novo review, why go through any of this? In any event, if you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer. Otherwise, I think that's it.
I haven't looked at this for a while. What does the court do about adoption of bylaws? Do we have to approve them?
I think so.
The state bar is supposed to publish the bylaw in the Wisconsin Lawyer, and then parties have 60 days to ask this court to review it.
That's what I thought. It's not an automatic review. They don't come here like a rule to do this.
Right, but
they can adopt it, and then if nobody objects for 60 days, it's
we might be day. Talking about this next fall.
I understand that. Mr. Levine, to explain the bar, the bar advised me that they would need time to look at this. And as you know, because it is an organization and does have rules, and the Board of Governors had to look at this petition before the bar could appear today, that that was done on the weekend because that's when the Board of Governors met. And this is April, and I put this on advising the bar of that and put it on as late in April as I could. To take into account the Board of Governors looking at this. So we all got the Board of Governors at the same
We did, memo. But there's a letter in the file in this proceeding from the State Bar President from last January who said we're having the meeting in February. Give us a reasonable amount of time after that to submit something. It's 9 weeks since February.
I know, and I am familiar with that and familiar with the fact that they then did it at the April, but I did set it so that it would come after that time so that we would have the benefit of their thinking. So it's been a pending a long time, but, of course, we've held it in abeyance, waiting the Seventh Circuit decision and then waiting to see whether there would be a petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as soon as you decided there wouldn't be, we attempted to put this on so we could get it started because it will not affect this year's, maybe not. I shouldn't give an opinion on that. The dues statements will go out, and what the effective date of any change would be is up in the air, but clearly I wanted this to not drag on for another year of bar dues in light of the Seventh Circuit decision.
I understand. Things happen.
Yes, they do. Do you have any other comments?
No, thank you.
Are there any other questions of Attorney Levine? Hearing none, does anyone else want to appear on this matter? Hearing none, I will now close the hearing on 0908 in the matter of petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 10035B1. The court will take a brief recess and we'll be out and we'll discuss these three hearings, these three rule matters, and attempt to make decisions on each of them.